As a human rights activist, my work is driven by the desire to implement positive change in our societies that advocate for the marginalized. As a woman and an intersectional feminist, I know firsthand that our societal structures still lack the adequate means of protection, liberation, and equality for women. As a mom of two daughters, I often think about the type of world that awaits my daughters as they venture out to discover who they are and who they want to be. Will it give them the same opportunities as their white male counterparts? Will it embrace them with all their flaws? Will it celebrate their womanhood as a strength, or will it weaponize it against them? These are the questions that I constantly struggle with and think about. But I find myself equally inspired by the women who bring these same concerns to the public sphere. These are the women who disrupt spaces that were never meant to include them. The women who reject calls for being passive and instead choose to use their voices to champion for our continuous liberation. These women remind me that we have come a long way, but there is still more to be done. It gives me great hope to know that among them, my daughters and I are in good company. Our guest today is one of these amazing women. She is an artist who uses her work to shed light on critical social issues and celebrate the women who are leading them. Last year, she compiled these portraits to honor 50 inspirational Pakistani women from various walks of life in a book titled Pakistan for Women. Please welcome Maliha Abidi.
I didn't realize it in that moment, but I can recall some moments here and there where I was supposed to feel inferior just because I'm a girl in Pakistan. And I never felt like that in that moment. I never thought that it's about gender. I thought it's just about an individual, you know, maybe that person sees me as an inferior. But now that I think about it, now when my brain kind of connects those dots, I can see that it was definitely about gender.
So Maliha, I will start with your book, Pakistan for Women, which was published almost a year ago, and then you took it on the road. Now that it's been a year, how do you feel?
So it doesn't feel like it's been over a year, firstly. And oh, actually, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. Firstly, I should thank you first before answering the question. And then, yeah, it doesn't feel like that it has been a year because, yeah, it's just, it's a constant adventure with the book because, like, I get messages from people, you know, who have read the book, who have heard about it. And I just feel really happy every time I see any comment related to the book or a message. Sometimes young girls, they take out time to write, you know, messages to me or emails to me that they're so happy to see representation, you know, brown girls like them are represented in a book like Pakistan for Women. So I absolutely feel so happy about it.
Maliha, were there any surprises along the way? Did you discover anything that you weren't expecting you would discover about women in Pakistan?
So I grew up in Pakistan, so I never kind of took Pakistan for, you know, obviously I didn't take the media's word for it even when I moved out of Pakistan. So I already knew my country pretty well, you know, I was born and raised there. But honestly, I didn't know about some of the communities within Pakistan because Pakistan is a very diverse country. We have people from all different backgrounds. So I was really happy to learn about different people from different backgrounds. But at the same time, some of those people, they were mistreated by, you know, the majority because they're a minority in Pakistan. So that was kind of quite disturbing to me because, you know, to see that there's this entire side of Pakistan that I wasn't that aware of. And I also was happy to see that how these minorities stood up against any injustice that they saw. Of course, it wasn't easy because when you're a minority or when you think that you're weak, you know, it's not always easy to take a stand, but I'm really happy to discover stories where women like Viru Kohli stood up against violence and just unfairness, a system that was designed as a modern day slavery against people like her, and she escaped it. And an amazing surprise that I, you know, when I was researching story of Viru Kohli, she went to the police first and the police didn't help, but then she was directed towards the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan. And Asma Jahangir, who's another woman in my book, and she was a human rights activist and a human rights lawyer. She was the one who co-founded the Human Rights Commission in Pakistan. So it's incredible what one woman did, and it helped another woman, and that woman was able to help other people in her community. So it's incredible, like, how our stories connect to one another. But yeah, there was a lot I didn't know. There was a lot I learned through this entire project.
So Maliha, I also want to talk about what you think about what's going on around the globe right now. And I want to mention a specific post that I saw on Instagram, your Instagram recently, which is getting a lot of attention. In that post, you basically talk about racism versus colorism. And I want to bring this up because you've mentioned how minorities are treated, how people are discriminated against. And I think this is a good segue into that post. First, I want you to talk a little bit about the post itself before we do a deep dive in it. And what triggered you to create that post on Instagram?
So that post, it was something that was on my mind for I would say several weeks now, because since we have, we have this huge conversation around the globe going on about racial injustice and police brutality, and especially against the Black community. During all of this time, I saw tweets and Facebook posts and just in general conversations from people from my community, from the Pakistani community, from Indian community, from people from Bangladesh, you know, like all South Asian people, various South Asian people. And I saw that how they were sharing about their experiences of feeling like they felt that they were discriminated against because of the color of their skin. That is horrible. Colorism is horrible. But the experiences they were talking about was, a girl at school called me dark, and now she's posting about Black Lives Matter. When I was in that grade, a teacher called me dark, or a relative of mine called me that, I should use a fairness cream. Or, you know, like, these things exist, and they're absolutely devastating, and they're disgusting. Colorism is, you know, it should not be acceptable at all. But at the same time, I just felt like that what you're talking about your experiences, while that's horrible, what you went through, it does not compare to what Black people in America or Black people around the world are going through, because it's not limited to the color of their skin. Because within the Black community as well, we have people who are lighter skin. They obviously, skin tones vary, so it's not limited. Racism is not limited to the skin tone. It's racism is connected to the roots of those people. So it's not that if a person is super dark, that's why they're going through racism. People in America, Black people in America, they're going through racism because they're Africans, they're African Americans, and their history, there's a system designed against them. Of course, it is designed against people of color, other people of color as well. But what Black people go through in America, we cannot just say that, we understand that as brown people just because our skin tone is brown or dark brown, or, you know, I just felt like that it's kind of watering down what we're talking about, and it's distracting from the conversation that so many of us are trying to have. If I understand that some people want to be a part of the conversation, but I think the best way to do that is to listen. If you are not sure about something, just listen to you know, other black people in the community read about it, watch documentaries on it. I would recommend watching 13th by Ava DuVernay. It's an amazing documentary. It's absolutely heartbreaking, but it's amazing because it teaches, like, it opens up your eyes to a very unfair system. So that's what was in my mind when I was creating that art piece, and it was just something that I just thought that it had to be said, and I used my platform to say it.
That's a great point that you're making, Maliha, because you are drawing a clear distinction between anti-black racism and colorism. However, colorism builds on racism, right? It is obviously not as crucial to talk about right now, especially with this renewed commitment to fighting against racial injustices, especially in America, and systemic racism that we've seen that has been specifically targeted at the Black community. But at the same time, don't you think it's important to have these conversations in parallel? Because most of the time, especially with migrant populations, our bias probably stems from colorism that we've experienced in our countries and how our brains have been trained to be more receptive to whiteness and to try to assimilate in white culture or adopt white culture more versus how we are towards the Black community. So how do we do that? How do we make sure that we are not taking away from a very important conversation, but at the same time, we have these conversations about colorism because honestly, South Asians have not had these conversations in the past. And it's a watershed moment in a way where they are realizing how colorism impacts our inherent biases.
So I absolutely do not think that we need to have a parallel conversation where on one side we're talking about colorism and racism side by side. I think there's plenty of time to talk about colorism. Right now we have a conversation going on about racism, and we should, especially racism against Black people, and we're talking about Black lives. So we need to talk and focus on that, because a very obvious thing is that it's not that easy to get people talking about something that triggered this, because Black people have died even before Mr. Floyd. So before that unfortunate murder of Mr. Floyd. But this was a trigger that was, and there have been protests in the past as well about other innocent Black lives where they were taken away, but this, what we are seeing right now, we need to keep it going. We cannot get distracted. It is, obviously, it's not as bad as saying all lives matter when someone says Black lives matter. But I think talking about colorism right now, I think we as South Asians, as brown people, we need to stand next to our Black brothers and sisters. Because if we start talking about, imagine a conversation where there's a Black person sitting and there's a brown person sitting, and the Black person is saying, you know, I fear for my life because I'm Black, and I've seen so many Black people die in my community. And then the brown person saying, yeah, I totally understand what you're going through, because I felt really sad because this one auntie called me dark brown and she discriminated against me, or she said I'm not as pretty. Like, these conversations, it just seems really, of course, it's not limited to, like, you know, just your looks. You're discriminated against based on your skin color on a lot of levels. But I just think that right now there are better ways to be a part of the conversation. I think a better way to have this conversation is once we take care of some things within the Black Lives Matter movement. For example, we keep the pressure going. We help change some laws. We help bring justice to a lot of campaigns that are going on right now. And once we do that, then we can talk about, maybe it could be a domino effect. We don't know. We don't know what justice will bring. Maybe justice will bring more than justice. You know, maybe it'll be a domino effect where once we get rid of so many things within this racist system, if we bring those things down, maybe colorism won't even exist, you know?
I completely agree with you that we cannot equate discrimination based on somebody's skin color in a predominantly brown population to anti-Black racism, which is systemic, which has been going on for centuries, which is much more deep-rooted, it is much more vicious. There is no way we can compare the two. What I meant was colorism in terms of our complicity in perpetuating anti-Black racism, or at least being silent about it, if not perpetuating, being silent about it. Because sometimes our opinions are informed by how we perceive color. As South Asians, how we perceive color. So it's more holding ourselves accountable for our silence or maybe our lukewarm response to anti-Black racism.
So I think, if I'm understanding your question right, I think that definitely will start within, from like our own people, because in South Asian countries, we have Indians and Pakistanis who are, and Bangladeshi who are from, you know, who their ancestors came from Africa. And now they are generations later, they're Pakistanis and they're living in Pakistan and they're born in Pakistan and, you know, they're spending their life in South Asian countries, including Pakistan, India and Bangladesh. Of course, they are mistreated over there because they're a minority. And I think that's a conversation we need to have within like our own community. I think that's how we can tackle it. I think if we see someone making any, firstly, there should be zero tolerance about racism. Like, we should not be not racist anymore. Like, it shouldn't be that, the bar shouldn't be that low. It shouldn't be, oh yeah, I've never made a racist comment. I don't see color. I don't see race. I don't hear, you know, whatever. I don't contribute to those conversations. That's not enough anymore. You need to be anti-racist. And to do that, I think the first thing, it's like with anything. You want to contribute to global warming, you start with yourself. If you want to contribute to racial conversations, you want to bring justice, you start with yourself. You start with correcting yourself, you start with correcting your circle, your family, and then you go from there. Then you contribute in more like other ways. There's so many resources out there to help, through which you can help different causes. So I think it's definitely a conversation that we need to have within our community first. And the colorism complex in South Asia, it's so deep in our culture that sometimes we don't even realize it. Like, I didn't realize how big of a problem this is until very recently, until several years ago. Even though I have seen people comment about, oh, that girl is so dark. Oh, this girl, she has a really white skin, so she looks prettier. You know, like these kind of things, even against boys. So it's not limited to just girls. These kind of things, they, of course, damage a person in more than one ways. And so, for example, I was just thinking about this. For example, if we are sitting like on Eid, let's say our families are gathered up, like all different families are gathered up and we're just having dinner or conversation, you know, like how if let's say I were to say a cuss word there, right? All the uncles and the aunties would be like, oh my God, how can you even say that word? In front of children especially, how dare you say that? Why would they react this way? Because it teaches bad manners, right? But very openly, the same uncles and aunties will have a conversation. Oh, that person is so Black. Oh, that person is from that country. Oh, that person is, you know, like, oh, that's an Arab. Even though Arabs are brown as well. Oh, that's like, you know, like these kind of like from just commenting about people's differences and thinking that you're better than that. But then nobody will say to them that, hey, that's teaching, that's worse than a cuss word, because a cuss word is just a cuss word. It's not a racial slur, or it's not discrimination against someone. It's just a word. Even though I'm not advocating for, you know, like cussing at the dinner table when your family's around. I'm not advocating for that. All I'm trying to say is that there are worse things people say, and it doesn't sound bad right there in that moment, but it is bad. If a child is there and if he's listening, if he or she is listening to what that uncle is saying about a black person or an Arab person or a person from another country, anyone, like, what, they're gonna grow up on those values. They are gonna grow up listening to those stereotypes. So stereotypes or insults against another race, I think we need to really monitor these things.
That's absolutely right. And I completely agree with you that we have to have these conversations within the confines of our homes first. See how we have been complicit. This is what I've been trying to do, how we've been complicit either in silence or not being as vocal and not speaking up as much against anti-Black racism. And I'm glad that so many people and communities are coming together and forming allyship with the Black community, which is so important. Let's pivot a little. You grew up in Pakistan and you describe your childhood as a constant art workshop because your family was very supportive of you and your artistry, which is great. I see that with my father as well. My Abu has always been championing for whatever cause I've taken up. And I'm so blessed, not just my father, my brother, my husband. It's like I've been surrounded by men who've always supported me, which is a great thing. Coming from a patriarchal society, many people don't realize how big a deal it can be. But Malia, how did comparing your experiences to others shape your understanding of women's rights in Pakistan? Because what you have, the kind of rights that you were able to realize, as you mentioned in the beginning, many women can't. So how did that inform your work?
So I'm still learning and growing as a person, and every day I learn something. You know, it's about checking your own privilege. So you asked that, how do I kind of understand that, what were my rights and what, like, how do I compare that to like other women who maybe didn't have the same rights? Or so I think it's about checking your privilege and then holding the other person's hand that you think is unable to voice their, you know, concerns or is unable to stand up for themselves. I think it's very important not to speak on their behalf, but just give them that kind of moral support. So growing up, I didn't honestly realize these things because it was never, you know, it's interesting. It's I didn't realize it in that moment, but I can recall some moments here and there where I was supposed to feel inferior just because I'm a girl in Pakistan. And I never felt like that in that moment. I never thought that it's about gender. I thought it's just about an individual, you know, maybe that person sees me as an inferior. But now that I think about it, now when my brain kind of connects those dots, I can see that it was definitely about gender. And in a similar way, now that the world is becoming a bit more, you know, aware of the injustices that go around, and within Pakistan as well, we have campaigns like the Aurat March, and we still have a really long way to go. Through Aurat March, it was so eye-opening because in the first Aurat March, there was a sign that a girl was holding, and she said, "Apna khana khud garam karo," warm up your own food. And she was dragged through the mud on social media. She was just a meme for several months. And when the next Aurat March came around, those trolls took out the same meme and then they reposted it, and they were like, oh, so the women are gonna say these kind of things because they thought that it's such a petty issue. But for that girl, maybe that's her biggest issue. Maybe she's trying to study and she's constantly being called to the kitchen to warm up the food. Maybe she's trying to have a job, but she was told, no, you're supposed to stay at home and stay in the kitchen. And maybe she was trying to, you know, like, we don't know anyone's backstory. Maybe that was her biggest issue. And that's what empowerment is to her, that, you know, if she doesn't have to do other people's chores, if she doesn't have to constantly do like other people's work, if she can't have that independence or that space or that freedom. So I think definitely it's a matter of checking your privilege. I may be in a privilege in a different way than other Pakistani girls. And I think I really need to check my privilege. I need to see what I have, what others don't have, not in a comparison kind of a way, not in a way where I'm kind of, oh, I have so much and the others have so little, not like that. More like how I can help others in my community and extend that hand of support so that they can raise their voice. Like I said before, it's not about speaking on someone else's behalf. It's about just making sure they're in a safe space where they feel safe enough to raise their own voice and raise their own, because women, like, women have always had a voice. They've always had power. It was just about nobody listened to them, you know, for a while. Nobody listened to them. Nobody paid attention to what they were saying. It, like, we have had fierce women since forever. So it's definitely about checking our own privilege.
And also striking this balance between empowered women in Pakistan and those who are not. Because what I really like about your book is that it debunks that one-dimensional perspective on Pakistani or Muslim women in the West. Most of the time, women are seen as oppressed, but your book basically is presenting a counter narrative that there are women out there who are empowered, maybe through their struggles, and they are showing allyship to other women. Let's talk about your generation, Generation Z. So you guys are reimagining feminism and human rights advocacy, and I'm loving it. What do you think previous generations can learn from your generation?
So before I answer that, I'm actually the oldest one of Gen Z. So Gen Z is like from 1995. So I'm like November 1995. So yeah, I literally like have to explain that because I'm kind of like in the middle of millennials and yeah, just like at the beginning of Gen Z. But I think Generation Z is they have a very different way of thinking. And one thing, well, social media has been around for a while, but how Gen Z, they just don't have any filter. You know, if I recall the kind of child I was, like, in Pakistan, I would totally be seen as a total Batmiz, disrespectful kid. But if you take me out of Pakistan and you put me in a UK school setting or an American school setting, I was seen as mature and straightforward. So there's a huge difference in how we see things within, like, different cultures. And Generation Z, I think they're very good at, I think social media has made it a very safe space for them to say something, because sometimes it can be intimidating to say it in front of people. So when you're just talking to a camera and you don't know who's on the other side receiving the message, I think that's very easy. That can be definitely a blessing. But at the same time, we need to be very responsible with social media, because there's so many trolls online as well. So we cannot be someone who spreads hate or, you know, spreads negativity. But yeah, I think social media has played, like, things like TikTok, for example, a few days ago with the Trump rally in Tulsa.
yeah, on TikTok, I saw that.
Yeah, I was just laughing so hard seeing all those TikToks where people were, like, reserving, you know, all the different teenagers who are reserving tickets for the Tulsa, and they had no plans of going, and they were just using such funny names, like, of K-pop stars and, you know, different singers, and just, yeah, a bunch of cuss words as well. So it's just amazing how they see things. You know, they take things very seriously, but how they approach a problem is very admirable, honestly. And I think what, like, the previous generation, what they can learn is they can learn to listen. I grew up listening to this thing, oh, you are not old enough. You're a little girl, you know? There weren't a lot of people who said that to me, but I'm sure there are other Pakistani girls who weren't allowed to say a lot. And they were just told, oh, you're either a girl and you can say that, or you are a little girl, you can say, you know, it's like so many limitations. So I think what the previous generations can do is have a collaborative mindset. Listen to what your kids or your younger siblings, or, you know, like, what they're saying. Just listen to them, what they're saying. It won't take a lot of your time. You don't have to agree with them, but just listen to what they, because it's a very fresh mindset. They are, I think a lot of the world is progressing because of a lot of tech. Social media is part of that. And they Gen Z is all over social media. So I think listen is what I would say for the previous generation, and be a bit more collaborative towards, like, have a collaborative approach.
So Malia, in terms of the idea of respect, and you and I both come from Pakistan, different generations, but we are both from Pakistan. This idea of respect is at the heart of what a family stands for, because Pakistan is a collectivist society. And in order to preserve that structure, societal structure, it's important that there is some hierarchical notion of how you respect your parents and your elders. And we see that in other East, like even in Eastern cultures as well. How do you think Generation Z is redefining that? Because growing up, although I'm from a different generation, I used to argue with my dad. And despite my dad being so educated and liberal, sometimes it was not easy for him to reconcile with the idea that I would just question him on things. Now it's different. How do you think Generation Z is redefining that in terms of how to respect your parents and elders?
I think that's a huge credit that goes to the parents as well. Because like you said, that your father it was difficult for him sometimes to, being an educated person himself, but it was sometimes difficult for him to, like, you know, when you used to counter him. Or so I can totally relate to that, because my father has always had an open door policy where I was never once stopped to voice my opinion. So I think it goes, a huge credit goes to the parents as well, where they're completing their responsibilities as a parent. They're doing everything to, you know, what a good parent does, but at the same time, and obviously this doesn't go for all parents.
Right.
This is like only a few good ones, because you have like some bad cases over there as well. But yeah, I think it's all about giving that confidence to your child that, okay, it's okay to say something. Because if it's okay to say something at your home, which is supposed to be the safest place, it's okay to say something out there. So you're able to stand up for yourself as well. I think Generation Z has been given that confidence from their parents. And I think I see those families a lot happier as well. They are so much more closer than with their parents than, you know, just treating their fathers, especially, like someone not to mess with, you know, like, why is it so serious in the house? It's just a family. He's not a dictator in the house. Like, he's a father, but I think it's the father that needs to, I think in the previous generation comes from the fact that mother used to be the one at home spending all the time with the kids, and father used to be the one working, and you know, when he came home, he was all tired and a bit grumpy, and you know, all of those things. So like, these things contribute as well. But of course, like, it's an effort from more from parents' sides, because kids are, they're obviously, like, when they're younger, they cannot kind of just have these big conversations that, oh, why am I not allowed to talk in front of, you know, it's just kind of implied, and then it becomes a habit. But I think Generation Z is different because they have that confidence that if I say something and my parents don't agree with it, I wouldn't get a beating, you know, I wouldn't get yelled at, or, you know, like, they would still respect my opinion even if they don't agree with me. They would still extend me that courtesy that, okay, you've been heard. So yeah.
Let's talk about your art, because I'm obsessed. I follow you on Instagram, and the best thing about your art is it's from all over the world. It started off with like Pakistani women and all, but I see so much diversity, and you pick these issues and topics and then you make them your own and you express them through your portraits, and you use bright, loud colors in your portraits. Is this a conscious artistic decision you made, or is it something that comes to you naturally because you just want it to be more vibrant?
Thank you so much for your kind words and, you know, the support. So with my art, I'm always very aware of that I need to have diversity, and it's always been that way. Even I think even way before then, I knew what diversity was, the meaning of this word diversity, because my art became super serious when I started coming across these major issues around the world, like in the Middle East, and you know, just Islamophobia, or you know, racial issues, or just any societal issues, or women's rights. And so when I started coming across, and because of social media, I came across these things, because no teenager is sitting around watching news. So when I was a teenager, that's when my art at 13 and 14, like, it started getting super serious for me. And I was learning about these different issues through social media. And that's when I thought that I need to do something to contribute. And that's when my art came in handy. I said, okay, like, maybe I can create an art, sell that, donate the money. Or I can create art and spread awareness. And, you know, like, these kind of things. But eventually, what kind of stuck with me was that we're all one, and we need to stand up for each other and for ourselves. So that's where that factor of diversity comes in. I just think that I cannot leave out anyone when it comes to my art. It's not limited to anything. And yes, I have a few causes that are super close to my heart, like women's rights, domestic violence, violence against women, education for children, especially because I'm Pakistani, we have we're the second country where we have the highest rate of kids not being being educated. So this is something that's close to my heart. But honestly, any kind of injustice, like, my art is not limited to that. Why colors? I think it's kind of like, it's not a conscious decision, but it's kind of like, I'm just so attracted to colors. So I'm a traveler, and when I go somewhere, it inspires me. Well, I haven't traveled in forever, thanks to quarantine. But yeah, when that inspires me. And traveling is something that me and my father, we bonded on like crazy. And now that I'm married, that's something that me and my husband, we love to do together as well. So traveling is a very positive part of my life. Even as a broke student, like, I try to somehow manage how to travel, thanks to Europe. Like, within Europe, traveling is you know, a bit cheaper. So yeah, I think that's where the bright colors come in. It's honestly sometimes like, nobody sees the behind the scenes, where I like rip so many drawings off the page. I just like throw so many drawings off my table, just rip them off. And when I like a final piece, it's usually big, bright, loud colors that I like to portray through my paintbrushes and colors.
And Malia, you're studying in the UK, and I was watching one of your interviews where you talk about how when you first moved there, artistic space provided you solace because you felt lonely. And this is such an important point, because many a times when we move from our countries, where we grew up, where we were born, to a new country, and we adopt that as our home, we are lonely at times. I was very lonely in the beginning. And there is some kind of, I would say, societal alienation in the beginning. You're just learning. People are learning to share those spaces with you. How was that experience like? And what did your art reflect initially when you moved to UK? Was it more based on what you were feeling at the time?
So as you said that, you know, you shared your experience, and I think a lot of immigrants, immigrant children or immigrant families, I think they, even if they move as a family, I think they can understand that feeling of isolation and just a cultural shock, I guess. And yeah, art became, I was 14 at the time, and as I said, 13, 14, my art became like super serious. And I think I was just, I remember some of the paintings that I was doing. I was working a lot with charcoal at the time. And I think charcoal, for me, when I think about charcoal, it's a very anxious, like, if charcoal was a feeling, it would be anxiety. Yeah, for me. And that's why I guess bright colors reflect my mood right now or my mental health right now. If you see me use charcoal, just understand that maybe I'm going through something. But yeah, I remember using a lot of charcoal when I was 14. And I don't exactly remember the things I used to paint, but I remember the medium, and I remember being in the library and just having that feeling of constant homesickness. Just even though it was a move to another country, I was just kind of like, when is this gonna end? And it was never gonna end because, yeah, you moved.
What is next for you artistically or academically? Because you are doing your master's, right?
Oh, actually, I'm doing my undergrad right now. I'm completing my undergraduate degree, yeah, in medical neuroscience.
So, okay, so let me rephrase it. You're doing your undergrad. What is next for you artistically or academically?
I have big plans. And right now, I have just finished my final exams for the semester. And I'm like done for the summer with uni and with online classes as well. So I'm just focusing on completing some of my art projects. One of them is my next book, which features 100 women of color from 30 different countries. So I'm very excited about that and to share more details about that. Academically, once inshallah I finish my degree, or at least when I'm like in my last year, I want to start an organization that focuses on middle class and lower middle class and women in Pakistan and women and children. And within that organization, I really want to focus on mental health and teaching them a few skills that they can use and maybe translate them into entrepreneurial skills as well. And also, I want to share the joy of art with them, because even if you're a housewife in Pakistan, firstly, you're not appreciated. You are seen as someone, I mean, housewives in general, I think stay-at-home moms or housewives, you're just someone sitting at home chilling, I guess. But that's not true at all. They have a billion jobs to do. But at the same time, they never even think that, oh, maybe I should take this workshop. Maybe I should take this gym class. Maybe I should take this yoga class. I'm talking about in Pakistan, middle class women, lower middle class women. It doesn't occur to them what self-care is. So within the organization, I also want to have a section where I want to introduce art. I mean, of course, they would know what art is, but I want to introduce art to them as a therapy. You know, that if you paint, even if you don't know how to paint, this is something that you can do for fun, because that's what art was for me. I was super lost. I was in my head. I was just all chaotic. And that was art gave me a lot of purpose in a time when I didn't, and especially as a teenager, you know, like as a teenager, you're already a bit messed up in your head. but yeah, I think that's what I want to. There, I have big plans for my organization, and you know, I want to build a team made out of people from my community, and I want to help people from my community. And inshallah, I see myself working really hard on it, and eventually spreading it across the globe as well.
And you mentioned mental health, which is such an important topic and tabooed, not just in Pakistan, everywhere. So it's very important to talk about mental health, to talk about self-care. People think, you know, all this is like, these are fluff words, and they are not. This is such an important topic to talk about, especially in countries like Pakistan. So Maliha, before we end, I was just again on your Instagram and I saw that you're accepting commission work. So where can people reach you? What is your IG? Can you give us some information so that people who are interested, they can reach out to you directly?
Yes, for sure. So they can reach me on Instagram at Maliha's Art. So that's Maliha, M-A-L-I-H-A _Z_ art, A-R-A-R-T. Wow, I forgot the spelling of art. And yeah, they can reach me out with the same username on TikTok and Twitter. And my website is just malihaabdi.com.
Thank you so much, Maliha. This was so good. And keep doing the wonderful work that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me on your podcast, Nadia. And you're also doing such amazing things. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you guys for listening to Maliha's story. I will be bringing a lot more stuff this season, more inspiring stories. As for Maliha's work, you can check her Instagram. We will be posting information about that. And if you have any questions about her work, you can reach out to her. We'll be posting all information about her on all our social media platforms. And until next time, when we come back with another story, stay safe and stay distant.